Our next case is case 10-1881, John T. Flynn et al. Versus Fairview Village Retirement et al. Mr. Lafayette? Excuse me, Lafayette.
Lafayette. Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court, good morning. Paul Lafayette on behalf of the appellant's defendants in this case, and I request 5 minutes to be reserved for rebuttal. The sole issue in this case is whether or not the denial of a motion to bifurcate, the motion being made pursuant to 2315-21B, is a final appealable order. The statute of the 2505.02B6 clearly states that a decision determining the constitutionality of those various tort reform provisions in Senate Bill 80 to include the amendments to 2315-21 are final appealable orders. And in this case, that is precisely what occurred. The trial court made a determination on the constitutionality of 2315.21. Just a very quick kind of procedural factual synopsis on this case. This case is a nursing home negligence case. The plaintiff was an 83-year-old, she's 83-year-old nursing home resident. The plaintiff asserted claims of negligence, violations of the nursing home Bill of Rights statute, wrongful death, and punitive damages. The case was proceeding through discovery. Depositions were being scheduled. On March 3rd, 2010, on behalf of my clients, we filed a motion to bifurcate the case in accordance with the provision of 2315-21B. The motion to bifurcate was denied on August 16th, 2010. Specifically, and this was in Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas, we received a card that said, defendant's motion to bifurcate, denied. That's it. That's all it said. In our motion, truly requested motion to bifurcate pursuant to the statute. That was what was requested. That's what was denied. Subsequent to the denial of the motion to dismiss, subsequent to the denial of the motion to bifurcate, we pursued an appeal to the 8th District Court of Appeals on September 13th, 2010. On September 20th, 2010, the Court of Appeals, the 8th District Court of Appeals, dismissed the appeal for lack of a final appealable order. It made that determination based upon the authority of Finley versus First Realty. However, while this was all happening, this court had recently heard arguments involving Havel versus Villa St. Joseph 2 weeks ago. While our case was being considered on the motion to bifurcate and then subsequently up on appeal, that Havel versus Villa St. Joseph was pending in the Court of Appeals in the 8th District. Ultimately, a decision came out on October 28, 2010, which was last year and is about a little over a month after the Court of Appeals dismissed our appeal for not having a final appealable order. A month later, they come out in Havel and say, you know what, it is a final appealable order, the denial of motion to bifurcate. The procedural histories are nearly identical. In Havel, they asked for defendants in that case asked for bifurcation pursuant to the statute. In our case, we asked for bifurcation pursuant to the statute. In their case, they got the little postcard from the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas denying motion to bifurcate. We had the same thing in ours. So procedurally and substantively, there's no difference between
different
what
happened. Panel, correct?
It may have been a different panel, yes.
These are running together a little in my mind, forgive me, since we had the other one just 2 weeks ago. Part of the issue here is, well, it's not certain that constitutionality was in play. Is that right or wrong?
Could you repeat the question?
It's not certain that it was a constitutional challenge.
Correct. Right. There is an ambiguity because the trial court's decision simply said denied. Didn't say why.
But that was true of the other case as well?
Correct.
That's what you're saying is in both cases,
right.
The disposition of the request was done in such a summary fashion that you can't tell from that case any more than you can from yours that the constitutional issue is in play.
Correct. To some degree, you know, in the Havel case, in the 8th District came back and made the decision that they agreed, and again, we're going down and now we're talking about a third case, which is the conflict case in Havel, which is the Hanners case. Hanners was a 10th District case, and again, the issue of constitutional conflict between the civil rule and the bifurcation statute was raised. In Hanners, they said, no, it was a substantive change, therefore it's constitutional. In the 8th District Court of Appeals in Havel, they said, no, it was a procedural change, unconstitutional, they're in conflict. But the Havel case did adopt the rationale of Hanners to the extent of saying, you know what, even though both of the decisions didn't explicitly say, in neither trial court decision, did it explicitly say, we find a constitutional conflict and that's why we're making our decision. The 8th District adopted Hanners' rationale and said, you know, it's fairly implicit in this determination that that's really the only logical thing that the trial court is making its decision on. And I submit to this court that essentially the trial court, when presented with the motion to bifurcate in our case, pursuant to the statute, which mandated bifurcation upon request of any party, that they essentially, the trial court had three options. Recognize that there's a statutory mandate for bifurcation upon motion of any party and grant the motion. Recognize that there's a statutory mandate for bifurcation upon motion of any party and deny it and just make the denial because you don't want to follow the law and you don't want to follow the statute, or I say the trial court. And the third option is make a determination that, yeah, we recognize that the statute says it's mandatory and it must be bifurcation, but we believe that conflicts with Civil Rule 42. Well, obviously the first option is out because they didn't grant it. The second option is out because I don't believe anybody here in this court or in the state wants to believe that a trial court is simply going to ignore the law because it feels like it. So the only rational option was, and the only logical conclusion, is that they felt that there was a conflict. The trial court felt there was a conflict between the rule.
So now, Mr. Lafayette, like Havel, like the Havel case, doesn't this all turn on the idea of whether this is a substantive right of your client to have the bifurcation? If it is a substantive right, then under 250502, it would become an order that could be reviewed because it's a final order that could be reviewed on appeal, correct?
Correct. And actually, there are really two arguments that we make, and I believe that they both, and I sat here for the Havel argument, and I thought there was some very intelligent question, obviously, from the court as to practical, particularly you, Justice Piper. No. But no, it was very practical questions were being raised as to how does this operate? What do we do with this? And I think one of the questions that obviously was raised was, you know, are we dealing with a substantive right? And I believe that there is a substantive right. And I believe that it's a substantive right for everybody, substantive right for the plaintiff and substantive right for the defendant to have a fair trial. And we all recognize that that if you, you know, you have a right to a jury trial, you have the open courts, you know, you have constitutional provisions that provide you with access to the courts and a right to a trial by jury. And implicit with that is in your 14th Amendment rights and constitutional due process rights to a fair trial. And what we would submit is, in this particular instance, what we're dealing with is punitive damages. Evidence of punitive damages should never be introduced into a compensatory phase or liability phase of a trial.
Are we going to get another determination then as to what is evidence of punitive damages?
Well, and that was a question, again, that was raised in Havel, and I believe that there are some very clear pieces of evidence that are never going to be compensatory damages. First and foremost, and the most obvious, would be evidence of net worth. The net worth of a corporation, opening its books and saying, this
so
is
we
how
could
much
agree on evidence of
right.
net worth.
Because no doubt, just as much as that wouldn't be admissible, certainly we'd have a mistrial if anybody brought up the issue of, here's how much insurance coverage there is. So, you know, if it would be a mistrial and if we brought it up for admissibility of, you know, admission of evidence regarding insurance, certainly it would be on the same lines with punitive damages as to what, in the compensatory damage as to the net worth of the company. But again, there were very good questions raised as to where along this continuum. Certainly there are going to be situations where some evidence lends itself into both. And I
if a case involved a number of falls, 12, 13, 15 falls, would they all be admissible at trial in a case like this?
I believe there's again, there's going to be some question as to the similarity of the falls or whatnot. I think the principal question is, my answer to that would be no. If there are 15 falls that preceded a fall that led to an injury that led to the lawsuit, and so long as there's no proximate causal to the ultimate injury. So long
that would be a determination a trial court would make on whether or not
right.
certain evidence would be admissible
right.
or would be going to compensatory damage or to punitive
right.
damage.
If we're dealing with, if so long as there's no relationship between fall number one and fall number 15 as far as what type of injury did it cause, then I would say no, it gets excluded. Because that type of evidence is not relevant to what actually happened on this particular day when this person fell.
We don't
That's
need
the
to
scope
reach those issues in this case because
no.
you're limited only to whether this is a final appealable order.
Correct.
And we should look at what to make that determination? The statute on
Well, I think there's
appealable?
Two, in our brief we argue two issues, and I'm watching my time here so I don't go over, but number one, the statute. The statute is clear. 2505.02b6 says there's an implicit determination. I think generally from looking at the Havel case, and I think it's fairly well recognized that, yeah, there was a determination as to the constitutionality. So I think if this court were to believe and were to adopt that, yeah, the statute itself is constitutional, then yes, it's a final appealable order. So that's the easiest one. The other argument that we raise is that I believe that, and on behalf of my clients, we believe that the denial of a motion to bifurcate is a denial of a provisional remedy under 2505.02b4.
Okay.
Because, again, recognizing my time here, the first step is to determine, is this, within the definition of a provisional remedy, is it ancillary? Is it an ancillary proceeding?
So now you've jumped beyond, you're dealing with, assuming we say the statutory provision is unconstitutional because it conflicts with the rule, now you're over into a motion to bifurcate under the rule.
And, correct.
And you're saying that as well.
Correct.
Final appealable
right.
order.
Right. Now, granted, I will acknowledge that in this particular case, our motion to bifurcate was based only upon the statute. We didn't say statute and rule.
So,
however, if we were to remand,
would Havel resolve your case?
Havel would not necessarily resolve our case. If the court finds the statute constitutional, yeah, it resolves it because it was a final appealable order, and the trial court would, I would assume, the remedy we would seek from this court is that the trial court be ordered, in order to save a step, be ordered to bifurcate the case based upon the authority of Havel. However, if this court says, no, we find that 2315.21b is unconstitutional, then I think we would, obviously our position would be, look, we're still seeking to bifurcate these claims, and I believe, and on behalf of my client, I believe that the right to bifurcate punitive damages
so
is a substantive right that we can pursue
even though,
as a
even though your
remedy.
Request to bifurcate was under the statute, if we say the statute is unconstitutional, you would have us go ahead and offer, wouldn't it be advisory if you didn't ask for it under the rule as well?
Yes, absolutely, because we're also making the argument that under the rule, if we were making a motion to bifurcate under the rule, I believe that a denial of a motion to bifurcate, even under the rule, is a final appealable order because it is a denial of a provisional remedy for those reasons set forth in our brief.
But counsel, just because the trial judge denied your motion to bifurcate does not mean that the trial judge is going to allow evidence of punitive damages to come in. The trial judge still has discretion over what evidence is admitted in trial. You could object, that objection could be sustained.
Well, and I believe that comes down to what type of evidence are we talking about? If our motion to bifurcate...
Can't the trial judge make that decision?
The trial court can make a decision on certain issues to bifurcation. And again, I will stick to my guns that when it comes to issues of financial net worth and things of that nature, or bad acts, things of that
None
nature,
of that's
prior
been introduced
bad acts.
At this point, right?
No, not in
so
our
the
case.
So the court could conceivably not allow that evidence to come in.
Correct.
Right.
Right. And if the court were to let it, were to say, no, we're going to deny your motion to bifurcate and we're going to let that evidence in, then I think it's a final appealable order and we should be able to appeal it.
But we're not at, that's not the
right. We're not at that stage right now. We're simply arguing that, this is a final appealable order and we should have had our day to
argue. Well, before you sit down, you want to volunteer your thoughts on whether it's one trial or two trials under the statute?
I think, and the way I view it is, I think it's, under the statute, I think it's one trial.
Right.
And certainly it's common sense, and I don't think anybody disagrees with that. I understand that it can be interpreted differently, but I can't see anybody.
Counsel, you're saying one trial, two stages.
One trial, two stages.
With the compensatory liability and compensatory,
right.
And then they come back and hear evidence as to punitive
Correct.
Damages, and then they reconvene and deliberate on that.
Correct.
What do you do with the jurors, the alternate jurors from the first go round?
With the alternate jurors, I think you have to keep them around. Because
how can you do that?
Well, if we're keeping the same jury,
right,
then I think you. Well, I guess that's an interesting question, but I think you still do keep them around. I think you have to, because if something happens in the punitive damage phase, you have to have the alternate available, and they have to concede that. Yeah, and I think Mr. Dixon, who was arguing in the Havel case, brought up the issue that, you know, if we start weeding out jurors, now all of a sudden we don't have enough for a jury. I think you have to keep the alternates around, and it would be no different than again, it's one trial, one jury, two phases. So I don't think you have to separate them out. I think you keep the alternates in there, and if something happens to one of the primary jurors that has been seated, and if there is an issue as to whether or not, if they already made a determination of liability compensatory damages, well, they've got to live with that. That's what the verdict was of that jury. And moving on to the second phase, if one of those jurors has to go, then the alternate fills the spot, and it doesn't affect the liability or compensatory damage award. Now we're here just to talk about the punitives. So I think it's reasonable. I don't think it causes undue duress or distress on anybody or cost or anything of that nature. So I would like to reserve the balance of my time, although I think I'm out. If I could have a few minutes on rebuttal, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Kress.
It pleases the court, counsel, Chief Justice O'Connor. My name is David Krause, and I'm here for Mr. Flynn and Ms. Gordon, the appellees. And although this court has spent a lot of time, not only today, but 2 weeks ago with the Havel case, discussing the constitutionality of this bifurcation statute, constitutionality was not an issue in this case. When defendants, well, appellants now, filed their motion to bifurcate with their answer, we opposed it only because it didn't ask to enforce the terms of the statute. It asked for much more than the statute. And in our case, such as it is, because we've pretty much been cut off from conducting any discovery while we go through the appellate process, we have a situation where an 83-year-old stroke victim fell a number of times. Many of those falls are not documented. We know that the Ohio Department of Health cited this facility for at least one of the falls for not documenting.
When you say that they asked for much more, what do you mean by that?
What they asked for, the statute provides that evidence that relates solely to the issue of punitive damages shall not be introduced in the compensatory phase. What their motion asked for was that any evidence that relates to punitive damages can't be in the compensatory phase.
And isn't that just a decision the trial court makes when they look at the evidence that's coming in compensatory? Here, the trial judge didn't even get to that stage. The trial judge says, you can't bifurcate. You have to try it all in one case. And so what forum then does the punitive damages come in if you only have one case?
Well, respect.
One proceeding since we. Well, first of all, let me back up. Do you agree that if the statute is found constitutional, there are two proceedings in one trial?
Right.
You don't have an argument with that. Okay, so if you don't bifurcate, then how do you keep out, and what form then do you hear evidence that is punitive?
I did not oppose the procedure that you're just talking about, and I put that in my brief in opposition. We did not oppose bifurcation pursuant to the statute. What we opposed were the extras. The evidentiary hearing that they add between the two stages of trial, the preclusion of any evidence of punitive damages, whether or not that evidence
but
might also weigh.
That's not what the court ended up ruling on. It didn't rule on the extras. It just said motion to bifurcate denied.
Well, that's all. My point, I guess, is that that's all the court was presented with. was a motion asking for bifurcation with the extras.
And the court reacted by denying bifurcation entirely.
The court denied the motion that was presented by defendants, and I think our position is that it's not the trial court's job to rewrite a motion to conform with the statute.
But the problem is we have the language. The court didn't say, I'm denying this part and this part and this part. The court just did one simple line that said, motion to bifurcate, denied, which, what do you think that means in terms of two stages?
Well, certainly appellants would have this court believe that that means the trial court implicitly determined that the statute was unconstitutional. I believe that the trial court, having been faced with a motion that under the guise of a statute asked to enforce the statute, but under the terms of the motion asked for much more than the motion, denied the motion.
And your response to that motion detailed your objections to the extras.
It did.
All right. And now, let's take this one step further. Say we buy your argument and we just in a entry said judgment affirmed. Now you're back in the trial court and he files a subsequent motion just to bifurcate pursuant to the statute. You're going to argue that he's foreclosed from doing that?
No. As a matter of fact, my brief in opposition to the initial motion to bifurcate suggested to the court that considering a motion to bifurcate with all these evidentiary rulings inherent in the motion was premature and that the trial court should revisit it before we try the case. So no, I do not believe they're foreclosed.
Counsel, the request that you're talking about in excess of what the statute provides for was in their brief, not in their motion. Is that not correct?
It's in the...
I'm looking at the motion. It says pursuant to 2315.21b1, defendants request the court issue an order bifurcating the claims for compensatory damages and claims for punitive damages as required under Ohio law. And the second paragraph says essentially they've set forth punitive damage claims, and under RC 2315.21b1, this court must bifurcate plaintiff's claim for compensatory damages and claim for punitive damages. Respectfully submitted a brief in support. So it's in the brief where they argue the language is imprecise, but the motion itself asks it be done pursuant to the statute, correct?
The motion does not contain the extras that are added on in the brief. And my concern, typically the way this works in the real world is I pick up the phone and I say, are you just asking for the bifurcation pursuant to the statute? And they say, yeah. And I say, okay, I'm not gonna oppose it.
But that's not what we had here.
But
that's what was in the motion, and that's the only thing the order addressed. It said motion to bifurcate denied, and the statute says you have a duty to give a bifurcation. So what should the court have said?
I believe that if the trial court was going to grant the motion to bifurcate only as to the statute, then the trial court could have. The trial court still can. We don't know how this case is going to be tried. We're way, well off from that.
Well, I guess we have a problem with the fact that the court just answered the motion and gave a blanket denial with no qualification. So we're left with that posture, not the what ifs, and we have to decide on the posture. Is that a final appealable order?
But I think one of the things that has already been talked about a little bit is that the Eighth District, within the span of a month, held that this case was not a final appealable order. And we talked earlier, you talked with Mr. Lafayette about the similarities procedurally between this case and Havel. And then the same court, albeit I believe a different panel, did not find that Havel lacked a final appealable order. And so what's the distinction? And the distinction that I'm urging this court to recognize is that in this case, they were not requesting simply bifurcation pursuant to the statute.
Even though that's what the actual motion asked for and that's what the actual order gave, you're saying because we have to read behind the lines and look at the brief and guess at what the court meant, makes it not a final appealable order?
You have to read, what I'm saying is that you cannot determine that the trial court implicitly determined the statute unconstitutional where there exists other good grounds for the court to have denied this motion.
Let's make that assumption. It's to say the court didn't make it, maybe didn't even think that, just didn't like the bifurcation and decided they weren't going to grant. Is it a final appealable order?
No, not as this motion and the brief in support are posed.
Even though the statute says it is?
The statute says that a motion brought under 2315.21 would be a final appealable order.
That's the motion they brought.
With a brief in support that asked for different things.
I'm going circular. All right, I get your point.
Well, counsel, you're not interested in litigating at any point in time the constitutionality of the provision.
No, you already did that in Havel.
Yeah, but you're not interested in that fight. So you're essentially saying we ought to improv this, I guess. I mean, what is there for us to say?
What I believe that this court should hold is that when you make a motion under a statute, you should request the relief provided in the statute, not relief that is, number one, an add-on to the statute, or in particularly as it relates to the distinction between any and solely.
Justice Kupp points out the bare bones of the motion follows the statute. So you want us to write an opinion that says if we found the statute, if we found it constitutional, you would still have us in Havel, you would still have us write an opinion. If we found it unconstitutional in Havel, you would still have us write an opinion. Right. Either way, saying he's limited to the bare bones of his motion back in the trial court. I mean, that seems like we're getting down into the.
If I had my preference, you wouldn't write any opinion, okay? And we wouldn't be here.
Well, we've got to review the work of the appellate court, don't we?
Right.
And we're not really going to tell lawyers what to put in their briefs. So the mission that we have is to craft some rule so that trial courts know what to do when they get these kinds of motions, and appellate courts know what the proper standard is to review them. That's all we're going to do.
Sure.
And the issue here is whether it's a final appealable order. You don't think it is. Am I correct?
Not as phrased. Not with a motion that has a brief and support.
You don't think it is
it.
Because that brief asks for something beyond the statute. And you want us to look and see the whole picture
and contrary,
not confine ourselves to what the Court of Appeals has written.
Correct. Not just in addition to the statute, but contrary to the statute. And the reason why it's so important in this case is because the appellants are trying to cut off our ability to conduct discovery on those issues because they wouldn't be admissible at trial before we even start the case. That's what this is really about.
Is there any reason for us to clarify, either in this case or in Havel, the procedure that Justice Pfeiffer talked about earlier, one trial or two, one jury or two, and what evidence is admissible? We don't want to get into the micromanaging of the admissibility of evidence, do we?
No, and I think that the statute as written says that you don't admit evidence in the compensatory phase that relates solely to the issue of punitive damages, and someone on the panel brought up the issue of financials and things like that, which would have no bearing. But Justice O'Donnell, you brought up the issue of, you know, we have 15 falls, and can you introduce evidence of the first fall in a case that's more about the 15th?
That's well, an interesting issue that a trial judge will have to work on, right?
Well, if the staff have a duty to be aware that the resident has had 14 falls and it directs them on what to do and what precautions to take with the resident, I would very much like to introduce that evidence, and I can see why
that's what a trial court will have to figure out. That's not for us.
No, exactly. But what I think the motion to bifurcate and brief in support as posed does, it's asking the trial court at a very early stage in the litigation to preclude any evidence that relates to punitive damages, even if it might relate to both. Even if it might relate to compensatory.
So should the trial court actually have issued an order that said motion to bifurcate pursuant to statute granted, the court will look at the evidentiary issues as they arise, or do a motion in limine and ahead of time, you can sort them out before trial so you know what you can get in and what you can't. That's evidentiary. That's what a trial judge does all the time. Right. That's the entry the court should have put on.
The trial court could have done that. I don't I don't know that.
Do you think the trial court had the right to entirely deny a bifurcation? Do you think the trial court had that right under the statute?
As this motion and brief in support were phrased, yes.
Even though that's not the motion or the entry say, we have to read the briefs to get that.
Right, the brief that's attached to the motion.
Well, wouldn't the trial court have a duty to grant what the statute required and deny the rest rather than just deny it all? Because in denying it all, they're also denying what the statute requires them to grant.
That's an important question, and here's why they do not. When you ask for relief that is not simply an add-on to the statute, but contrary to the statute, in other words, appellants would have had the trial court change the statute from evidence that relates solely to punitive damages to any. So they wanted the court to enforce bifurcation with a change in the word of the statute. I do not believe that it's the trial court's duty to then discern when appellants have overreached in their motion and say, well, we would have given you this, but you asked for all this.
Why wouldn't it be a trial court's duty? That's what they do all the time, don't they? They grant what is grantable and they deny what's not grantable, or should.
Some do, yes. but I don't believe that it's the trial court's obligation to edit the motion and brief to make the relief requested conform to the statute.
They're not making the relief requested. He can request whatever he wants. What he's making is that the ruling by the court is limited to the statute. And that, like Justice Kupp said, that's what a trial court does.
The ruling does simply deny the motion. And if the court is saying that, well, we know that there's a brief in support attached, but we're only going to talk about the two-paragraph motion, and that didn't mention all the extras, then I think you're right. But if you read it all in all together, which is how they're filed and how the courts decide them, I think that this is an overreaching motion. I don't think the court implicitly declared the statute unconstitutional.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You may have 2 minutes.
Counsel, in listening to this, it strikes me that there doesn't appear to be any disagreement between the two sides as to how this case is to proceed at this point, and until you get down to specific matters of evidence, and that perhaps it's here because Havel was traveling the same route, and
Havel got there
first. Otherwise, you'd have a much bigger dispute going on in front of us.
Correct. I would have been arguing Mr. Perry's case from 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
And I agree with you. I agree that, in part, I think we're both on the same page as far as the bifurcation, the statute, and what it requires. And to some degree, you know, the constitutional issues we're really not here for, although I think they are significant, and they certainly play into, again, the arguments that I raise in our brief with regard to, I think, provisional remedies, and regardless of whether we're dealing with the statute or the civil rule, I think that there is a right to a final appealable order, regardless of whether you made the relief requested under civil rule or under the statute. That being said, I think, the most important thing that comes out of all of this, whether it be in Havel or in this case, particularly Havel, is that there be some clarity and some guidance for the trial judges. I mean, you know, as trial attorneys, we're out there and we see the difficulty of the job that a trial judge has on a day-to-day basis of dealing with the issues. They're not all fine line. It's not all, yeah, absolutely that comes in, absolutely comes that it doesn't come in. There are discretionary issues.
Counsel, if we're laying aside the question of the statute, and let's assume the statute isn't there in the future, the mechanics of getting whether it's a final appealable order under the rule or not, wouldn't you ordinarily be much further along in the development of evidence before that fight started? Because here you haven't done much discovery yet, as
right.
We understand.
Right, yeah, we haven't concluded
discovery. So, wouldn't you be further down the road where you can see what he's trying to shove in that you think is really something that, under the rule, should be in a separate trial.
Right. I agree to the extent that, yeah, we didn't get to the point where they actually asked a question. However, is the plaintiff's counsel ever not going to ask a question? Yeah. Are they ever not going to try to get in net worth? You know, they're not going to, you know, if the allegation is negligence of a particular nurse on a particular occasion in their handling of a patient, they never ask for introduction of the evidence of the nurse's net worth. They want to know the facility's net worth. So that question's always asked. And, you know, did we jump the gun a little bit maybe and ask for, you know, bifurcation? Maybe, but we would have gotten there at some point eventually. But I do want to stress that, you know, first of all, in our particular motion, and granted it may not be a relevant issue right now where we stand, but the motion to bifurcate in our case, I don't believe was contrary to the statute. You know, it did the solely and any, you know, again, that falls within that gray area. It's semantics as to, you know, those issues as to solely dealing with punitive damages. Well, at the end of the day, it's going to be the judge that makes the determination as to what solely and solely doesn't. And so when we say any, maybe we should have said solely, but I think it's just a matter of semantics. I don't place that much stock into it. But again, the final thought I do think that we want to leave the court with and would hope that the court can address, both in Havel and in this case, is just some clarity for the trial judges out there as to one jury, as to the bifurcation issue on punitive damages, making sure that there is a fairly clear, bright line rule so that judges can apply it universally across the state.
Well, let's push it back. You said as clarity as to one jury. The rule sort of implies if you're going under the rule, two trials, doesn't it? The way
it
you
says,
read it.
Well, I guess in that's perhaps since this is the court and you make the rules, particularly that rule, that under the civil rules that could be clarified, because while it does say two trials, I don't think it necessarily excludes the fact that it could be one jury, two trials, or two phases. Again, it could be a semantic interpretation by the court or the legislature as whether we're talking stages, phases, or trials. There is a trial on punitive damages, separate, you know, even though it's one jury, even if, whether you're talking about the statute or not.
So we need to clarify that as well.
I think so, and I think that would go a long way to resolving many of these issues that the trial judges face and the litigants face. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you, gentlemen. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?
All rise.